Hey everybody, I'm Craig Eastman, and this week I managed to get out of that old transistor radio I was trapped in for the last podcast. Sorry it's taken us so long to get back to you. Various things have intervened in the last few weeks. Certain cosmic events have coalesced to stop us from getting to you sooner, but they're all sorted out now. We've made them better. So joining me tonight, as always, is Scott Morris.
Greetings.
And Drew Tavendale.
How do you?
We've got a bit of catching up to do tonight. So as well as some more recent releases, such as Gran Torino, The International, Watchmen, and Benjamin Button, we'll also be trying to hurry through a list of other ones we should have got to you with about 2 weeks ago, but I was too lapse in my behaviour to be able to take part. So without further ado, let's get on. Clint Eastwood seems to be able to do little wrong as a director recently, and his most recent effort, Gran Torino, is doing little to dampen that inertia. It's a tale of an embittered racist Korean War veteran, Walt Kowalski, played by Eastwood, whose neighbourhood is slowly being taken over by Asian families, when one of the young members of said families tries to steal Kowalski's prized Gran Torino car. Old Walt is understandably miffed by the situation, but as a fragile friendship develops between the two, he takes the youngster under his wing and eventually ends up protecting him from the gangs for whom he becomes a target. I have to say, Gran Torino is another one of these sort of sedately paced efforts from Clint Eastwood. If you're after all-out action, which the trailers rather mistakenly seem to promise on television, it does look like basically Dirty Harry just outside of a retirement home, you should probably look elsewhere. But I quite enjoyed Gran Torino, one of the better films I've seen recently. Scott, what would be your opinion?
Likewise, really enjoyed it. Take some issue with you describing him as racist. We had the discussion when we came out of the cinema. It's not actually racism if you just hate everybody.
Yes, this is true.
He just doesn't like the whole human race, I think. Well, it's probably a racist in the true term. It's like the whole human race he dislikes intensely.
But yeah, it's a nice little mix. There's plenty of scope for little bits of pathos and drama because he's a Korean War vet and he's trying to reform with Korean families, so he's conflicted with that as well. And there's a lot of things to like in there, and there's very few things not to like. I've no earthly idea how Clint manages to make Walt Kowalski quite so likable, despite the fact that he's clearly a cantankerous old bastard. He's the grumpiest of all grumpy old men.
Yeah, I mean, he really should have been called John Curmudgeon rather than Walt Kowalski, shouldn't he have done?
Somehow he retains a sort of strange charm, which just actually makes the film work, where it's quite easily, if you've got someone less talented, it would have just been a risible character that you wouldn't have cared for at all. So by the time it actually gets to the end, you'd actually feel some kind of connection to Walt, and that does make it work quite well, I thought.
If there's any one gripe I had about the film, it's that Clint Eastwood rarely seems to play outside of type as a grumpy old fella, but then perhaps 50 years into a movie career doing just that film after film was perhaps a little too late to sort of get on a bandwagon about it. But Drew, are you in concurrence with Scott?
Certainly am, yeah. I thought it was excellent. There's nothing of note that I disliked about it, and I just think extra plaudit ought to be given to Clint Eastwood for giving such an awesome performance by simply growling through half of the film.
It's what he does best.
I don't think ever before I've seen anybody do so much with simply going...
He really doesn't need his 44 Magnum anymore, does he?
No. Well, as he showed in the film, he just uses his finger, which is apparently enough, but his finger and that growl.
If only the car had exploded, that would have been it.
Oh,
that would
be Swordfish, wouldn't it?
Yeah, compared to his most recent film, which was Changeling, obviously, both far from electrifying thrill rides, but I think of the two, I have to say, I clearly prefer Gran Torino. Performance-wise, not perhaps up to the same kind of level as Changeling, but just overall, I think it clocks in about, I don't know, 40 minutes shorter or something crazy like that, or maybe it just feels 40 minutes shorter.
It's not making any attempt to stretch the boundaries of cinema or anything here. It's a plainly plotted little drama, and there's no real... Well, he always says there's never a message to any of his films, but it's clear that there's not a message here. It's just some little drama that's been worked up. But if it's going to be his last performance in front of a camera, at least, then it's a fine note to go out on.
Absolutely. No complaints here. Yeah. What more recommendation could you need? Go and check out Gran Torino. The International, something of a timely thriller. It stars Clive Owen as an Interpol agent on the trail of a dastardly bank, the ICCB, I believe, who are up to all kinds of shenanigans and arms dealing and all the rest of it. You really don't need to know much more of the plot than it's all about banks being evil. And as we all know at the moment, banks are evil. So it really couldn't have been it couldn't have been any better placed in time. Scott, I had high hopes for the International from the trailer. It looked like it could have been a nice mix of financial intrigue, if there is such a thing, and action, but it seems to revolve around one sort of admittedly impressive action set piece about two-thirds of the way through the film, and suffers greatly after that towards the end, which kind of took the edge off it for me. Is it anything more than a worthy potboiler?
Wouldn't even go so far as to say a worthy potboiler. It's certainly not worthy, and I'm not sure it gets hot enough to boil anything. I just found it incredibly tedious all the way through. I mean, this is by the same director as Perfume, which you can...
that was a cough of the evil memory of that film. Sorry about that. Please don't mention that name again. I may have to kill you.
Well, it does all the things for being the one bad Alan Rickman film. So that's an interesting thing in itself. But it was a terrible film. And this is not terrible in the same way. There's the bones of something perfectly competent and understandable here, but it's just so slow and so drawn out that it never actually gets anywhere there.
Well, this is also the director of Run, Lola, Run, which was one of the most consummately paced films I've seen.
It just felt like those long stretches where very little was happening to it. You've got a main character whose actual job does not actually have him do any of the stuff that we'd be doing here. He's running about being an investigative officer, despite the fact that that's not what Interpol do. And so I guess they were trying to go for, he's a loose cannon, but it just comes across as being someone that doesn't know where to stop. Clive Owen, while he does well enough with his role, and is, as he always does, there's just really not much there for him to get his teeth into. Investigation seems patchy. The bank itself may as well be called the International Bank of Evil. They do not appear to have any. You can't go and deposit money for them. They only say, we only sell arms to people for some reason. Really? Why? It just seemed awfully tawdry, and there didn't seem to be an awful lot going on in there that was of any interest, and by the end it just tumbles down into a series of deus ex machinas that really left me completely unsatisfied, as I had been all the way throughout. Can't think what you would do to make it a better film apart from just completely rewrite it, so I can't really offer any criticism of anyone in it. I think it is well acted, it is very well shot, it does often look quite pretty, and there's some very clever framing going on. It does look visually quite inventive, but the story itself just isn't there.
As far as these things go, it's as shallow as a tinker's bath, really. It's not going to stretch anyone's grey matter at all. I thought it nipped along fairly well, and sort of the big set piece was well enough staged, but it's never more than lackluster. Drew, does that ring true?
Yeah, it was just turgid and pointless. And it's like, it doesn't tax your grey matter at all. But if you do bring that into it in any way, shape or form, it begins to make even less sense. Well, you have corrupt police officers uncovering potential assassins, and then you apply any thought to about how they went about doing it, how's that going to work? How are they going to explain that away? And conveniently, they don't bother. And the set piece too, which I was distinctly unimpressed by, again, because it just made so little sense. You spend the first half of the film setting up the fact that this bank is using an assassin to take care of people who are in their way and make it look like other people, that sort of thing, being really subtle and dark about it. And then all of a sudden, they just, in the middle of a art gallery, in the middle of New York City, 300 people turn up with automatic weapons.
Shooting up a famous American institution. Never mind. This sort of thing doesn't necessarily need to pivot around sort of gunfights and whatnot to provoke some sort of tension. I think of The Insider, and it's obviously a tobacco company rather than a bank, but quite similar in themes. And I think The Insider didn't even have a gunfight in it. I mean, the only the only appearance of a gun in The Insider is when a fella finds a bullet in his mailbox, and yet still it managed to be a good factor of two or three times as tense as The International was. I've no real gripe with The International, other than it was just incredibly bog standard all the way throughout. I wouldn't necessarily go and recommend anyone to go out of their way to see it, but if you intend to go and see it anyway, then I'm not going to try and put you off. I felt it was vaguely passable. Unless you recently died, you probably can't help but have noticed a curious case of Benjamin Button doing the rounds on poster sites throughout the land. It's the closest David Fincher has come as director yet to garnering any kind of Oscar, and I should tell you right now, quite rightly, didn't. It's the story of a young lad who is born aging backwards, which is to say, he starts out a tiny wrinkled old man and should theoretically end up a gigantic little baby. A gigantic little baby? So wait a minute while I reset my oxymoron switch. It should theoretically become a gigantic baby, but doesn't, because nobody thought through the logic of it. I have to say, there's no point to Benjamin Button. I cannot think for the life of me what it was trying to say, other than, wouldn't it be really awkward if you were born an old wrinkly man and became younger as you got older? Scott, what is the point of Benjamin Button?
Well, it doesn't have a point, and I'm not sure you can really put too much credence on a lack of internal logic. I mean, you've just described what the film's about. It's not exactly... logic is not its strong point, is it? I didn't mind it too much for about the first 3/4 of the film, when it's actually based around Brad Pitt. I still find him a likeable enough actor, and his experiences and what he goes through is, for the most part, relatively interesting. Towards the end, it kind of falls apart somewhat. I suspect that is mainly because you're starting to rely on Cate Blanchett for all the dramatic chops, and that's not going to work very well. In terms of it having a point, well, it doesn't really. I'm not entirely sure what it teaches about the human condition, if anything. I don't know what it's trying to say about relationships, other than, yeah, wouldn't it be weird if this happened? And yes, it was weird when that happened, but that doesn't... it's not really something I need to worry about too much. I've got this far in life without aging backwards, so I'm probably... I'm going to make the assumption that I can go on from here aging normally and not have to worry about these scenarios. So I don't really know what it was trying to teach me. Let us say it's semi-enjoyable. I think it's about 2/3 of it okay, although not a film that I'd ever want to see again. Mm. And 1/3 pretty poor. Go away, Cate Blanchett. Go away.
Drew, do you share our apathy?
Yeah, I can't. It's a reasonably okay film for the most part. It's reasonably enjoyable, but again, as soon as you're starting to rely on Cate Blanchett to carry the film, it just stops dead, although it still seems to carry on for about another hour. And the internal logic, though, does bother me like it does you, Craig. And okay, you buy this fact that this person's aging the wrong way around, but then at some point he's going to be fully grown and not shrink. Why would he shrink?
Why would he be born aging backwards in the first place?
It's okay, but the main thing I thought is when I was watching this, thing, I've seen this film before. It was called Forrest Gump, but it
exactly.
was much better.
Exactly.
It's part of the way it's told and the way it looks feels quite like Tim Burton's Big Fish, but mostly it's like Forrest Gump. So you've got this sort of strange, slightly disadvantaged person who has all these adventures and keeps running into this one woman throughout his life who's the most important thing in it. So it's very like Forrest Gump in that way, but without being in any way good. Well, not in any way good, but... And yeah, I've seen this film before, done much better and less stupidly. So I can't say... not see it if you want to see it, because you'll probably get some enjoyment out of it, but I certainly wouldn't encourage anyone to go and see it.
No, I've got to say, it does seem to be by far the weakest of the Oscar contenders that was knocking about. It just doesn't seem to have any real meat behind it. It's just something, it's an experience, then it goes away, and then you never think about it again.
It's one of these ones you think made it into the running, the sort of final five films, because people sat down and thought, oh... well, it must have some kind of point, yeah. It certainly seems very worthy, but well, we should probably put it in. And I don't think anyone's actually sat down to consider what the point of it is, what it's trying to say. It's like you say, this guy, yeah, okay, he's had this sort of string of, you know, life experiences. Don't we all? What is added to it by the inconvenience of aging backwards, I'm not entirely sure. So it was a great opportunity for Digital Domain to flex their visual effects muscles and break some new ground. But other than that, well... if that's your bag, that's your bag. But it's the first film in a long time I've actually fallen asleep during, so take away from that what you will.
Watchmen.
Possibly the only person not singing the praises of Alan Moore's seminal 1985 comic Watchmen is Alan Moore himself, because having seen his previous works turned into a string of Hollywood turkeys, apparently he's not too happy about the same thing having happened to Watchmen. It's a tale of some dysfunctional superheroes who aren't really superheroes, set in an alternative 1985 America, where Richard Nixon is still in power and all manner of doomsday-related shit seems ready to go down as the US prepares for nuclear war with Russia. It's a dark dystopian view which seemed to work well enough on the page, but Alan Moore himself claimed the work to be unfilmable. Not entirely sure what that means. I hear it bandied about a lot. Doesn't seem to make much sense, because clearly it is filmable, and the man for the job on this occasion has been Zack Snyder of 300 fame. Scott, I'm a man who can appreciate the aesthetic nature of things as much as anyone else, but even for me, 300 proved, once again, as shallow as a tinker's bath. I haven't seen Watchmen yet, but it certainly looks like Snyder's put all of his visual prowess behind this one. Does it suffer from the same problem of being obsessed with visuals at the lack of, at the expense of storytelling?
Surprisingly, no, and it's an awful lot better than you'd probably expect from something by the director of 300 and a screenplay from the guy that does the voice for Solid Snake. But this does turn it quite well. If it has a fault, and I don't know if it's a fault or not, but it is very slavish to the graphic novel. You can basically look at panels and shots in this film and they are essentially identical. It's very, very keenly informed by the source material. I suppose the reason that Moore preemptively disowned it was that a lot of what makes Watchmen good is not actually the narrative in Watchmen, which is actually its weakest point. What I found so good about the graphic novel, which I read about 2 weeks ago for the first time and was massively impressed with, is really the care and attention that's gone into creating the world that these people live in, as well as the characterisation and the backstories of everything. It's almost an ensemble character piece more than anything else. And all of that has managed to make its way into the film. What I'm not sure is how much of it I am kind of filling in my head when I watched this on screen and just sort of took the experiences that I already had and the knowledge that I already had from the source material and sort of filled in, spackled in gaps of it. I'm not sure to a complete virgin to the experience how comprehensible a lot of it is and whether they would get quite the same experience. I still think even if you haven't seen anything about Watchmen at all, it is a very strong film. It not only looks great, a lot of the characterisation of these superheroes and their foibles and their character flaws makes it in here, and it does make a far more interesting, it makes it a kind of logical progression from The Dark Knight, if anything. It is not a massive action film, which the trailer again would kind of sell you a dummy on, because it's largely based around the closest thing it has to a big action scene in it is a breakout from prison. That is grossly misselling it. It is mostly, obviously, a fairly high concept character piece when you're talking about a massive blue man with powers of God. But it does somehow pull all that together and work very well on screen. I honestly can't think of anything that I would want to see put into this that it would make sense to put into it, and I can't think of anything that you'd want to take out or change, especially given that at, 2.5, 2.75-ish hours, it's already a fairly long film.
Mm. I have to say, I feel quite sorry for Snyder, and that Alan Moore's been so forthcoming in his vitriol for the project in general, and he's made some quite cutting remarks about it, some of which seem to be quite personal against Snyder, who's largely maintained a dignified silence on the issue.
And it's very strange because it's almost reverential what's going on here. It is so close to the source that it almost is like seeing the graphic novel, someone just turning the pages for you.
Well, I have recently read, listened to and watched numerous interviews with Alan Moore, and the impression I'm left with is that Alan Moore is actually a bit of a knob. he's made a whole lot of noise about the fact that he told the studio he didn't want any money from the movie project on the proviso that they just not associate his name with it, that it's not Alan Moore's Watchmen. And yet I haven't heard him saying anything about not taking any royalties from the presumably massively increased sales of the graphic novel, which I see on the shelves of every single Borders in the land. Borders and Waterstones at the moment seem awash with copies of it. He seems very keen to dismiss it before anything, before having seen any. Well, he's made it quite clear that he's no intention of ever watching it, so how in that case he can have an opinion on it. But he also seems to have it in his head from the start that this, I think purely because of the sort of the mythos revolving around this this rather seminal graphic novel, which again I myself have—I so far haven't read.
I mean, it's all very well saying that it's unfilmable. Certain bits of it are unfilmable, but whether you need to actually film those unfilmable bits to make it a good—well,
here's my issue. All I hear him say is it was written to be unfilmable. It's unfilmable. I've heard people describing it as being unfilmable. No one has yet qualified for me what the term unfilmable means, because I cannot think of a single thing in the world. We've said this about films before. I've heard it bandied about films. It's unfilmable. Now, in what way, shape or form is any concept not can we not commit it to celluloid? It's ridiculous to say that something's unfilmable, especially when it's in the form of a graphic novel, which is essentially a film fucking storyboarded for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's storyboarded in a book form.
I perhaps see where it's coming from in the fact that a lot of material in this is actually text. Each episode will have like a couple of pages of it's like an extract from one of the characters' autobiographies or something like that. It has some kind of written material which doesn't really fit into the narrative and it doesn't fit in, and you couldn't really shoehorn it in anywhere else. It's just sort of, it's almost like background material. And there's certain parts of it which does sort of encourage you to look at it, sort of look at some image on a page and then go hang about and flick back about five pages and look at something else just to compare and contrast. And there's bits of that which don't translate directly to being a film. Now, I don't think that is necessary to the experience.
Well, that again, yeah, exactly. That's not to say it can't be adapted to circumvent that. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous of him to say it's unfilmable, so I'm not going to look at it, and Zack Snyder's a bastard, basically.
Yes, I agree. Especially because I thought this was absolutely fantastic. It seems to polarise people. It's either really great or really bad. I thought it was really great. It's perhaps a little more violent than the original. I'm not sure what the reason for that is, whether it's just to drive home certain points. I mean, I've already seen misguided reviews and things like the Daily Mail saying that it glorifies fascism and things like that. Because you've got one of the characters, Rorschach, is essentially a violent, crazy fascist.
Did you say the Daily Mail had taken umbrage with it?
Who would have thunk it?
That bastion of common sense.
Yes. And essentially, it seems to be there more to drive home the points that the two of the main characters that actually drive the narrative forward more than anyone else is probably Rorschach, and even though it's more of a... And the comedian takes a big part in the narrative, even though he actually dies at the start of it. And both these characters are total fucking tools. They're evil bastards. You really need to drive that home, I think, more to just keep the audience on side and anything else, because Rorschach's actually quite funny. And it'd be quite easy to actually sympathise with him, but you really shouldn't, because he's mental.
Yeah, batshit crazy.
Yes. And the rest of it turns out to be basically about human interaction, whether these people are superheroes or normal people or whatever. It's a film about humanity more than anything else. It's a film about attitudes. It's a film about, as is the graphic novel, it's a film about society and what it does to itself. There is a narrative. The narrative is almost not worth mentioning. As I say, it is by far the weakest point. It's actually been changed slightly to tidy up the ending, I think, more than anything else, and basically keep it to under 3 hours. And I have no real complaints with that, because it does keep... A lot of people have complained about it, but I don't think it's anything worth worrying about, because it does keep in touch with the spirit very closely. And, as I say, the narrative is by far the weakest point in both the source material and this, but even that aside, I thought it was fantastic and I loved it.
There we go. Drew, could you possibly have anything to add to that? Was it as grand an experience for you?
Oh, I thought it was excellent, and I've never read the graphic novel, but I will be buying it within the next couple of days to make sure I can read it. And Scott was saying he was worried that he'd been filling in things in his head having read source material, but he's thought he'd been doing that, but I don't think he had, because unless there's something obvious that I've missed when I find it when I read the graphic novel, I thought I got everything from it.
Yeah, I'm quite intrigued to do approach it from the same way that you've done, Drew, and I might take in the movie, see if I find it comprehensible, because a lot of people seem to find it quite labyrinthine, and then I'll check out the graphic novel and then watch the film again.
Well, that's exactly what I intend to do. It's when I came into the cinema, I planned right away to read the book, and we've already made plans to go and see it again in a fortnight.
Yeah.
Which I'm very happy to sit through it again. Yeah, I thought it was excellent, and I was sort of very unsettled with the first start, even though I was certain that the trailers would have been misleading. It still sort of puts you in the wrong frame of mind, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sort of unsettled for a while, we got into it. Because the trailers do make it look like a big action piece, and it's not. And it just seems stupid to market it like that, because an engine is going to piss people off.
It does have a big blue man with his cock out, though, doesn't it?
It's swinging in the wind. Swinging in the wind.
But yeah, it's just one of the most cerebral comic book film there's been to date, and that's just fantastic for it. There isn't a great deal of plot, and that isn't the point. It brings up the sort of things, issues, that, like, for instance, at the end of The Dark Knight with the scene on the boat. It makes you think what you might do in that situation, and then the rights and wrongs of what they're doing. And it's just nice to actually have a film that genuinely makes you think.
Yeah, I've got to say, for all the carping that people will have over this film, you will walk out of this film with many, many more things to think about than, say, Slumdog Millionaire. It provokes far more thoughts and raises far more questions than 90-odd percent of films that I've seen.
I've already done a great deal of thinking about it, mostly along the vein of how hot Malin Ackerman looks as a brunette.
Yeah, it is very cerebral, though, and it's so worth seeing it. And it's weird, I haven't seen, say, like The International or some shorter films that felt like they were dragging. And I didn't notice a single minute of the time passing in Watchmen, despite it being almost 3 hours long. And that's always a good sign.
I'm intrigued to see it, if for no other reason than I hope that when I see Watchmen, I thoroughly enjoy it. And if I do, I'm going to write Alan Moore a strongly worded letter calling him a Well, I shall refrain. I should like to sternly point out how wrong he is. I may see the film and I may absolutely hate it, in which case I won't. But I promise you, listeners, that if I do find it enjoyable, I shall write that letter and I shall keep you up to date with what happens. Probably nothing. Yeah, I pointed out during the long and incomprehensible introduction to this podcast that we struggled somewhat over the past month due to various events and scenarios within which we, the three of us, found ourselves. We weren't able to bring you comprehensive reviews of titles such as Shea Part 1, Frost Nixon, Slumdog Millionaire, Milk, Valkyrie, JCVD, or Me Can't Nora's Infinite Playlist. We're going to rectify that situation right now, as briefly as we can. A, to make it more interesting for you. B, to save us from doing a separate podcast. And C, to stop us from getting particularly bored by films we saw anything up to 2 months ago. Okay, guys. Milk. Gay man. He go to Washington. He dead now. Worthy.
Well, he go to San Francisco. Close enough, but less remarkable.
He has ambitions to go to Washington, is what I mean.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, man.
That's what I mean.
He dead now. Worthy.
Really liked it. Great performance from Sean Penn. Probably deserved that Oscar. Very touching, very affecting. Loved it a lot.
True.
Excellent film, excellent acting. Deserved Oscar, probably one of the few. Made me astonishingly angry. Wanting to throw things at the TV because, not because of the film, but because of what was happening with people in the film. Stupid religious people, homophobes, bigots, etc. Highly recommended, but you may want to take some blood pressure from education.
Especially when much of that stuff is happening today again. So
yes. Not a great deal has changed, unfortunately.
How relevant. Valkyrie, Tom Cruise, Nazi, he try to kill Hitler. It no work. Everybody dead now. Worthy, but not quite.
For what it's worth, enjoyed it. Doesn't really say much about anything, but at the same time, it's quite enjoyable. Lots of English people pretending to be Germans. Why? But enjoyable enough thriller, despite the fact we all know what happened in the end.
It's what it drew. It felt to me like sort of latter-day Boyzone stuff, but for little purpose other than to probably make a bunch of German actors angry that they didn't get any of the jobs. Did you find it enjoyable?
Yeah, good film, good performances. It shows that Tom Cruise can act
even
when
with
you take away all the Scientology nonsense. And yeah, it's worth watching. Quite interesting from a historical point of view.
Absolutely. I thought it was engaging enough. There we go. Frost Nixon. He interviewer. He not a president. He's still alive. He dead now. Worthy. It's typical Ron Howard fare, isn't it?
Actually, no. Typical Ron Howard fare is a hell of a lot more sentimental.
Mm. I should point out that I haven't seen it. I'm just guessing that it's typical Ron Howard fare. I have shot myself in the foot somewhat.
Remarkably free of sentimentality. It's a tale of a young television whippersnapper, David Frost, played by Michael Sheen, interviewing Richard Nixon, disgraced bastard, played by Frank Langella. Great supporting cast from Oliver Platt, Sam Rockwell. It's punchy, it's dramatic, it's important. It's a lot of fun. I liked it quite a lot. I have no complaints with it whatsoever and enjoyed it a hell of a lot.
Drew, his whose house it is.
Much as Scott said, yeah, it's a very good film. Michael Sheen does a great line in impersonating famous people in a non-parodical way. I would perhaps have liked a bit more of the actual interview, but I suppose I could have just watched the actual interview if I wanted that. Yeah. So it's perhaps a foolish want. And yeah, very enjoyable and not at all sentimental, which is quite pleasing for Ron Howard.
I'm working the assumption that there's not an introduction set in the White House where Lloyd Grossman goes about trying to give you clues as to who lives there. And then David Frost, an elderly David Frost, tells you.
I think that's going to be a special edition.
Sweet. That would be good. Still, Nixon is dead now. Shea Part 1, presumably to be followed by Shea Part 2. He rebel. He hang about with Castro. He morally grey. He dead now. Worthy.
I'm not sure. Are you saying worthy as a statement of fact or is it a question?
No, all these films we've mentioned so far are sort of certainly very worthy films.
I appreciated Shea. It's a very methodically paced, I guess, would be a polite way of saying it. Plodding would be a little less polite way of saying it. It's very sedately paced.
Certainly is.
Especially for something that takes part during a civil war. You expect there to be a few more bangs and bumps.
A very boring revolution, as it turns out.
But as someone, I don't really know an awful lot about Che Guevara, apart from, you know, he's on T-shirts a lot. So it's nice to get filled in a bit on the background of him. I suspect Che Part 2 is where all the really interesting things happen. at least in terms of the guy's politics and what he believes in. Mm-hmm. This one's more of a sort of gentle lead-in, but yet still manages to take up, what, 3 hours or something.
I feel particularly aggrieved that Del Toro was overlooked for any Best Actor nominations at the Oscars this year. Would you be in agreement with that?
He certainly at least deserves a nod. It's a very good performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, but as far as I'm aware, pretty much the entire Oscar shortlist was wrong anyway, so it's probably not worth considering.
So what was your opinion overall of the film then, Drew?
Yeah, it was good. interesting. I think Scott's right that the second part, which I've not seen myself yet, will probably contain more given it's subtitled The Gorilla. Yeah, I would have liked just a bit more about the actual man and his motivations, particularly. I mean, I guess you might get some of that from The Motorcycle Diaries with Gael García Bernal, which gives a bit of his early life. But that was a different film by different people, so you can't depend on people having seen that. And I just,
still best described as worthy.
Yeah, I don't know what the second part would do, a bit more of that, but I would just like a bit more of his motivations, politics, why he was like that. But yeah, certainly worth watching.
I would have liked to have had a little bit more of him maybe on a cookery programme, telling you some of his favourite recipes. That's just me. Slumdog Millionaire. Everybody seems to be talking about it at the moment. I can't think of a sort of jaunty summation for you in a silly voice without it coming across as slightly racist, which I certainly wouldn't intend, because it seemed like a nice enough little film. Couldn't help but feel a bit aggrieved by the advertising, the promotional material for it, which makes it out to be the feel-good film of the year, which for the first hour and a half, it certainly is not.
But it was a poster for Mamma Mia. It's exactly the same poster. Yeah. Like, falling from it. And like, oh,
exactly.
It's so happy. It's going to be quirky. Miserable.
Money raining from the sky. Oh, wait a minute. I'm going to have to take a bit of a beating on that story arc. It's still a very, very good film. I'm not entirely sure if it should have won Best Film, but it's always nice to see Danny Boyle, some homegrown talent on the world stage, one of our most consistently excellent directors. And I thought it was very, very good. Would anybody disagree with that?
No, I thought it was a very good film, but it certainly didn't deserve to win Best Picture.
No.
Because it's not, so even a couple of years, you're not going to go back and think, oh yeah, that was brilliant. You probably forget it. Mm. And
interestingly,
it wasn't even the best picture of the year. Not the best picture of the year. It wasn't even Danny Boyle's best film by quite some margin. I thought it's a very good film. It's enjoyable. It's worth watching, but it's nothing special.
Still very good. There's an interesting theory doing the rounds, which I've heard, and I can't remember where I heard it now, but apparently a lot of money coming into Hollywood at the moment is Indian money. It's one of the few places in the world where there's still a bit of cash knocking about in their growing economy, and with belts being tightened, whatnot, Hollywood are quite keen to do as much handshaking as they can with Bollywood, and that may well be the reason why this film has been perceived to do so well in the eyes of the Academy and those kinds of institutions. So not entirely sure if there's anything in that, but I would highly recommend checking out Slumdog Millionaire. Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. I haven't seen it, I haven't got a clue what it's about. Looks shit. Anybody do any better than that?
Fairly standard, typically dreary teen romance that doesn't even manage to have, despite being called Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, doesn't mean you've managed to have a particularly impressive soundtrack. It's alright. Michael Cera from Superbad I can imagine him polarising opinion, because you either think he's a really bad actor or an impressively natural actor, and I find him quite natural and quite believable, but it's just sort of meh. That's how I would sum it up.
As an interview, I don't think it's a bad film. I just think it's a film that's marketed at people that's about half the age that I am, and it's written with them in mind, and it's written with their experiences in mind, and it's nothing really to do with me, so I guess my opinion doesn't really matter one way or the other. I thought it was okay. I have no real complaints with it, but as I say, if you're over about 15, there's no reason whatsoever to watch this film, because you'll have seen it before, many times over. Yes. But yes, it's well enough done. A strange choice for the director of Raising Victor Vargas, which was very highly acclaimed in little indie film, and why this seems to be all he's done, apart from, I think, a couple of telly things, is a bit of a mystery. I thought he would go into bigger and better things than what is essentially a fairly generic drama.
Yes, he'll deserve to have done.
Oh yeah, Victor Vargas was one of the best films we saw that year, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. quite impressive that it managed to actually make that ridiculous comment from the New York Times, it's like sunshine burning through a cloud bank, actually not sound so ridiculous after all. I think, well, yeah, I wouldn't have put it quite that way, but yeah.
wouldn't have sugarcoated it quite that much, but yeah.
Yeah, as I say, no complaints, but then again, no real reason to watch it if you're over 15.
And finally, perhaps the most interesting curio, and a surprisingly rewarding effort for anyone who manages to catch up with it, it's out on DVD already, is JCVD, starring JCVD himself, Jean-Claude Van Damme, playing himself. as himself, being himself, being down and out, making crap films, and somehow getting caught up in a bank robbery.
Well, he's playing kind of himself in the same way that Eminem's playing kind of himself in 8 Mile. It might as well be. You know?
It might as well be himself, yeah. It seems, I couldn't help but feel watching this that more than anything, it seems as if it's Jean-Claude Van Damme searching for some sort of catharsis. It does seem to be him sort of laying down his life in front of the camera, including court battles over custody of his children and whatnot, and sort of saying, oh, this is me. Isn't my lot actually a bit shit for all the sort of, you know, for all the attention and fame that I have? And I'm not entirely sure what the purpose of it was, but by God, it was entertaining.
I can't think of a more imaginative or use of what is nominally a sort of heist slash action film that I've ever seen in my life. This is just, it's just so inventive. I can't quite work out how this managed to actually work in any way, shape or form. It should have fallen apart, it seems, within the first 2 minutes.
It's not even audacious, it's just stupid on paper.
It's the thing you look at it and go, this can't possibly work, but it's fantastic.
Initially,
let's put one thing out. It shows that Jean-Claude Van Damme can actually act, especially in his given language.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Jean-Claude Van Damme can act, and that the scene in the post office where he sort of comes out of the action is a bit over the top, but it's like giving this really long monologue to camera. Like, wow, boy's got some acting chops there. How surprising.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually the one scene that didn't work in the context of the film, but it does show that he's a great actor.
Yeah, I'd say it was a bit much.
A decent actor, at least. You get this strange sort of metadrama where it works as a sort of character analysis of everything that Jean-Claude's done in his life up to this point. And it's interesting in that respect, and yet it also still works as a fairly generic-ish sort of heist drama, where he wanders into a bank which is in the middle of a heist, and for some reason is mistakenly fingered as the man who's actually pulling off the heist, which provokes a little bit of a drama around it, and there's a hostage standoff, and it's all sort of very Dog Day Afternoon things you may have seen before, but it still works as a standard heist drama, and it works as a strange character analysis, and it works as a sort of showcase for Jean-Claude Van Damme. And the fact that it works at all is remarkable. The fact that it works at all these levels is just fantastic.
Yeah, I can only think to describe it as some sort of a mental dream committed to film. And it does, it's bizarre that it's on paper, it just, no one part of it should work on paper, let alone the sort of the gestalt entity that is the finished film. But mostly bizarre. I have to confess, the first time I watched this, I fell asleep halfway through, but that's because I was trying to watch it at 1 o'clock in the morning, and that wasn't happening. And I immediately the next night watched it again from the start, because I was thoroughly enjoying it up until the point that physical stress had made me go to sleep.
Well, I think I said when I was suggesting it that we watch it for a podcast that it did sound like a bad dream. Perhaps it still does, but it's a really good dream, not a bad dream. So yeah, it's well worth watching.
Bizarrely enough, I mean, I can't think of many more films. I mean, obviously, it's not, perhaps not critically as worthy as some other ones we've spoken about tonight, but in terms of inventiveness and just sheer entertainment, I actually can't think of many. If you're familiar with Jean-Claude Van Damme's canon, I mean his body of work, not his gun or anything like that, and, I can't actually think of something more interesting to recommend to you, because it's quite unique.
If you have seen any Jean-Claude Van Damme film, you owe it to yourself to watch at least the first 10 minutes, where not only will you be treated to the best studio ident I have ever seen.
Yeah,
that is great.
But you also get that fantastic opening sequence where it's like the really long tracking shot of him like doing this big action sequence, kicking people in the face, and it's one big long tracking shot. And then he sort of barges through the door at the back and confronts this very bored Japanese director. And he basically confesses, it's really hard for me to do this. I'm 40-odd years old.
Yeah.
It's one of the best openings I've seen in a good long while.
It's incredibly audacious.
Does such a great job of subverting your preconceptions about somebody like Jean-Claude Van Damme. Mm-hmm. And sadly, you can't imagine, though, it's sort of a running gag in the film about Steven Seagal getting the parts he's going up for, but you just can't imagine something like Seagal doing this. But
yeah, I'd be interested to see if it will happen, but I'd be interested to see what offers he gets off the back of this, certainly, because it's the only opportunity I've ever seen him had to flex any kind of acting chops, and he does actually have them. I just can't help but feel that it's been under-marketed slightly, and the vast majority of people will just say, oh, it's a Jean-Claude Van Damme film. I don't like him. And I don't really think it... In fact, it may even help if you don't like him, because you're going to see him in a completely different light if you give this film half a chance. It's absolutely bizarre, but fantastic. Fantastic. So there you go. It's a bit of a shame we didn't get to do that as a separate podcast at the time, actually, because it probably would have been the most worthwhile one we've ever recorded. Not really many bad films amongst it, perhaps, except Nick and Nora, which, from what I can gather, he's saying, is not even really bad. It's just...
Scott's right. It's not really for us. It's more... It's middling. Yeah, can't say it's bad. It's not particularly good either. But, there weren't any bad ones in that lot.
There we go. Quite a shame that it was reduced to me making silly impersonations. Well, listen, guys, thanks for listening. We shall try and not be so delayed in our next conversation with you. But until such a time as we can get round to that, I've been Craig, and, of course, Scott was Scott.
Bye.
And Drew was Drew.
Bye-bye.
Catch you all on the flip side, as we like to say. Cheerio.
Just the usual existential malaise caused by modern day
existential malaise. Is there a better kind?